community events. This KABU program is made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Wilkin & Company, PC, Certified Public Accountants, helping businesses, individuals, and nonprofit organizations make financial decisions based on their personal values since 1987. Wilkin & Company is located at 2435 Southwest 5th Avenue in Portland. Information at 503-225-1359 or wilkincpas.com.
Good morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host, with this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. A few species of trees have come to define what was once the nearly treeless landscape of California. Only two of these iconic species are native to California, however, coastal redwoods and giant sequoias. The other three, eucalyptus, orange, and palms, have, like most of California's residents, come from somewhere else. This morning, Jared Farmer, author of Trees in Paradise, returns to finish up a conversation we started during the last pledge drive. This morning, we're going to talk about how California's iconic trees make us look at what it means to belong or not belong, to be native, alien, or invasive, and how the way we define the trees around us is a reflection of how we define ourselves and our neighbors. Jared, welcome back to Locus Focus.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you call your book A California History. So for of all places, why would you want to do a history of California through the lens of trees?
I think it's probably the only state in America you could do that way. I was thinking with Oregon, you'd probably have to bring in fauna. It'd probably be like salmon, Douglas fir, wheat, I don't know, maybe hops. I'm not sure what the forest would be. California is the only state, not just America, but the whole world, that has multiple national parks devoted to megaflora. You know, you have redwoods, the most valuable tree agricultural economy in North America, maybe the whole world. If you think of almonds, oranges, a whole host of kind of Mediterranean tree crops that only grow in California for the North American market. And it's probably the only place in America that's really advertised itself, promoted, you know, brought in tourists and would-be residents by using trees as symbols, especially palm trees, but also oranges and earlier pepper trees and eucalyptus, using trees to kind of symbolize the California dream, the good life. I mean, to some extent, Miami Beach and Honolulu did that later, mimicking California, but California really, I think, invented that and more than any other state. So it's for that symbolic reason, for the economic, and then for just these remarkable native trees, trees like redwoods and sequoia that grow basically nowhere else. There's other examples like torii pine, which grows on one bluff just north of La Jolla. Other trees like Joshua tree, bristlecone pine that sort of achieve their greatest form in California. So for a bunch of natural and unnatural reasons, I think it is a unique kind of arboreal landscape. So that's why I chose California. In addition, I love California.
And you used to live here. You used to live in California too. Actually, I was thinking this morning about, you know, why tree history of California as opposed to a tree history of Oregon, because actually the image on the Oregon license plate is a Douglas fir. So we do have our iconic trees here too.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, of course. And you could add to, you know.
However, I think that what struck me about California, I mean, in Oregon, we don't think of most of our iconic trees as being non-native species. I mean, our iconic trees are like the Western cedar and the Douglas fir and innumerable other species of fir and pines. And they are, we have a lot of the same issues that exist in Northern California around logging of these iconic native trees.
Right.
However, we're not so attached to non-native species.
That's true. I mean, it's in part because, you know, Oregon's agricultural economy has long been focused on the Willamette and to some extent, you know, the eastern side, but that's much more about dry farming. And probably if Americans could have totally transformed Eastern Oregon, they would have, but they didn't have the kind of money and infrastructure that California did, because, you know, in California, they basically retrained all the rivers of the Sierra Nevada to transform the Central Valley. In Eastern Oregon, you just didn't ever, I mean, there are reclamation projects out there, but just not on the scale. And it's kind of a high, cold desert, so a lot of these valuable tree crops that you can grow in the Central Valley wouldn't grow in Eastern Oregon, even if you had this enormous kind of infrastructure that you have in California. So there's a couple of reasons why it turned out differently.
They never did find as much gold around Baker City as they found in the Sierras. And also, I'm happy that they didn't retrain all the rivers in Oregon in the same way that they have completely transformed the California water system. In fact, probably the greatest river running through California is the California Aqueduct.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if you fly north to south, from like Portland down to L.A. and you look down, it's just amazing, the landscape in the Central Valley, because it's these ribbons of concrete, some of which are, you know, highways 99 and the 5, but then essentially man-made rivers. There's like a bunch of parallel versions of the California Aqueduct that are transporting water from the north to the south and serving these tree farms along the way. It is just one of the amazing transformations of the American West and one of the most consequential. And, you know, it's incredibly valuable. And this tree crop economy in California is worth billions of dollars, but it is hardly an innocent transformation. And if you think about what used to be there, it wasn't like a biological desert by any means. In fact, it was often quite wet. The Central Valley flooded most springs, and you'd have these enormous lakes, seasonal lakes, but with millions of migratory wildfowl and, you know, grizzly bears and elk down in the lowlands. I mean, to a lot of American settlers, it seemed like a bipolar wasteland. They just couldn't understand this place because it was basically a desert that flooded every year, and they just couldn't wrap their minds around that. And so eventually they basically drained all of the wetlands and filled in the vernal pools and put the rivers in concrete. And that's how you can grow, you know, millions upon millions of almonds and other trees in the Central Valley.
Well, I think about the transformation of Western landscapes and these stories that you don't learn about growing up, but I've learned as an adult. And the two maybe that blow my mind the most here in the Northwest, it's the drowning of Celilo Falls, this incredible falls in the Lemon River that rivaled Niagara Falls and was the greatest falls west of the Mississippi. And the other one that is even in some ways more mind-boggling is the draining and disappearance of Tulalip Lake in the Central Valley, which I guess was the largest freshwater body west of the Mississippi.
Area most years. I mean, it really contracted and expanded depending on how much snow fell, but many years it had a greater surface area than Lake Tahoe. It wasn't very deep, of course, but yeah, it was an incredible lake. If you look at old 19th century maps, it's this giant blob bigger than Lake Tahoe that's a little bit north and west of Bakersfield. I mean, today you wouldn't even know.
Well, now they have to irrigate the land, don't they?
Now they have to irrigate, and actually the land is subsiding. It actually has dropped like 10 or 15 feet. For a long time, it was, cotton fields. I mean, that's where a lot of the Okies ended up, was like the former Tulare Lake. It wasn't the only lake, though, that disappeared. If you think about Owens Lake, it's now essentially a salt pan, and you get just these nasty dust storms. I mean, L.A. does now put a little bit of water on it to keep the dust down. Basically, L.A. took the river, the Owens River, and dewatered Owens Lake. There's Tule Lake up near the Oregon border in northwest California, which is a fraction of its former size. So you have these like three very large lowland lakes that either were disappeared or reduced. And then meanwhile, you have the Salton Sea, which is like the through the looking glass version of this. This is a lake that is not natural, that probably shouldn't be there, but because of all this irrigation runoff from waters that has been imported to the Imperial Valley, you have this like totally toxic yet necessary for wildfowl lake in the middle of the hottest, driest desert in North America.
And that's actually that lake was a major engineering mistake.
Yeah. I mean, originally it's like the Colorado River busted through a levee, but since then it's actually, it would have dried out eventually because it's so hot, except that it became such a hot spot for winter produce. You know, basically, if you're in the Northeast, or really anywhere in North America, and you're buying fresh produce in the winter, it's coming from the Imperial Valley. And it's all irrigated agriculture. And when you irrigate, you know, some water runs off because they need to push the water down the furrows, but that means there's excess water, and eventually it goes to the lowest spot. And it's this big basin that's actually below sea level, and so things just are captured there. But the water picks up salt and toxins, and this is at the very, very end of the Colorado River Basin, so it's turned into a real kind of ecological disaster. But it's also necessary because these other lakes no longer exist, so birds that migrate actually need the salt and seeds. So it's like a very difficult situation where, like, should you restore or try to restore something that's not natural and toxic because these other lakes, like Tulare Lake, are basically gone forever. And the Colorado River Delta is also in, like, very bad shape, which would be an important part of this kind of migratory ecosystem for birds, but is largely gone because of upstream use. So, yeah, it's a very difficult issue. So when you think about trees in California, it's not just trees, but it's about rivers, it's about lakes, it's about wildlife. I mean, to create these gainful orchards all over California that grow, you know, these wonderful crops that we all love to eat, really had profound ecological and also social consequences if you think about, you know, laborers and things like that.
Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with Jared Farmer, who's author of Trees in Paradise, and we're talking about the relationship that California has to its iconic trees, both native and non-native. And I think it's a story that we can reflect in our own, wherever we live, because I think that most regions have, to some degree, an iconic relationship or with their trees or lack of trees. The salt and sea, just to me, before we move on to the trees, it has so many lessons in it. And I think that it makes me think the attachment. There are people, I interviewed this guy a few years ago, and I was doing a project about the Colorado River, and interviewed this guy whose big mission is to save the salt and sea, and he's been living there half his life. And it's a funny place, I suppose, called Salton City, which is kind of the remnants, the real bare bones remnants of
a resort, and now it's
a ghost town with his house and a post office. And I actually went into the public bathroom there, and all these pigeons flew out, which I thought was also very endemic of it. But I think about people attached to trying to save something like the Salton Sea, and also being in a kind of a conundrum about its value versus its detriment. And it reminds me of people's relationships to the eucalyptus, particularly in the wake of so much cutting down of the redwoods, which are California's actual native iconic tree.
Right.
So let's talk a little bit about this struggle. It seems to be a real Californian struggle between, that starts with misappropriation or exploitation of resources, and then trying to fix a problem and creating bigger problems.
Yeah, yeah. So I'll just maybe, like, start with the currency and then move back. Because, like, now you do have these odd moments, especially in the Bay Area, where you have tree lovers fighting tree huggers, or, you know, basically people who love eucalyptus trees who are appalled that environmentalists want to cut down eucalyptus trees. And but, you know, both sides have, you know, like, I think a profound sense of place and a love for the environment, but often value these trees very differently. So the question is, like, why did Californians bring in eucalyptus in the first place? There's a bunch of reasons, but one had to do with basically overuse, over-harvesting, and just wanton destruction of California's native trees, especially oaks and redwoods. You know, from the 1850s onward, Californians just, you know, blasted through natural resources like there was no tomorrow. And, you know, very quickly, California decided that, you know, we need one that grows in the lowland that kind of fills that oak niche. And they needed it for firewood, especially because California didn't have good coal reserves. But they also needed it for building material. And they also actually wanted to make it more beautiful because a lot of these settlers are coming from Eastern places or European places or, you know, South American places that were more wooded. And they just, a lot of them just didn't like California the way it looked. They thought it was beautiful but also incomplete, and they wanted to kind of complete the picture. And so eucalyptus trees, of all of the possibilities in the 19th century for a hardwood that would grow kind of in the oak niche, seemed like the best choice. And in fact, you know, the British Empire used it, the French Empire, all over the kind of Mediterranean zone of planet Earth, people were growing eucalyptus by the billions in the 19th century. It's the most colonial tree of all time. It grows really fast. It's really adaptable to a variety of environments, and it grows well from seed. So it's quite cheap, and there was actually pretty good transport between Australia and California as of the 1850s. A lot of gold miners actually came from Australia to California. So that's why they chose this tree. And it did amazingly well in California. You'd have trees growing to like sequoia-like size, like 200 feet tall and like so wide that you'd have to have, you know, like five or six men wrapping their arms around it in 50 years, which wouldn't happen today, actually. There was this kind of moment in time when these eucalyptus trees would basically grow as if they were in paradise, because they were. And the reason is they came as seeds. They came in basically like envelopes, little tiny seeds, which means that insects did not come with them, and birds that fed on eucalyptus, and fungi, and viruses, and koala bears, and all sorts of things that evolved with eucalyptus in Australasia did not come with them to California, because they came with seeds, and there was this huge barrier of the ocean, and this is before, you know, modern container shipping and trans-Pacific jet flights. So they came to California, the trees, and they just grew as if were, you know, like God's greenhouse. And again, that wouldn't happen today. Today, because of globalization, there are all sorts of Australian diseases and insects in California. A lot of these trees are quite sick because of it. And they actually look more like Australian eucalyptus trees. When Australians came to California, like circa 1900, 1920, they were just blown away. They said, like, these are eucalyptus trees? Like, they don't look anything like eucalyptus trees down under. They're, like, they're way too tall and healthy looking. And so I think a lot of Californians of that kind of post-pioneer generation, you know, like into the early 20th century, people like Ansel Adams, who took loving portraits of eucalyptus trees, saw a kind of affinity, you know, because like they came from somewhere else, but they came to kind of feel like they belonged in California. Here's a tree that came from somewhere else, but it became deep-rooted and grew to these mammoth proportions. And I think people had that kind of, I don't know, like psychological, emotional attachment to it. And I think for a lot of people of that generation, eucalyptus became the look of home and the smell of home. So it's really not until like the late 20th century that you start to get a backlash for various reasons, which I can get into. But I'll stop now in case you have any, like, you know, questions or
Yeah, actually, I want to get back to why eucalyptus proved to be not quite the trees of paradise that they started out to be. But you have a statement at the end of your section about the redwoods, and it's right opposite a photograph of a giant eucalyptus tree and these two guys who are only with their arms stretched out, covering less than half of the circumference of the tree. But you say that California is a place that inspired the most naked form of American acquisitivism, and this is the place that first inspired Americans to set aside national reserves. And so I wanted to go back to the story about the sequoias and the redwoods and as a kind of a lead up to get back to the eucalyptus and what kinds of, what was the first impulse that the redwoods and the sequoias inspired in American settlers, the European derived settlers, and how did that in fact create a reaction of protectionism.
Because you're right that this kind of naked greed on display is one reason why people wanted to bring in eucalyptus trees. The tree planters, these kind of horticulturalists, they position themselves against the figure of like the lumber looter and the gold miner who just, you know, wanted to make a quick buck in California and take off. They said that we want to fix that, but back then they weren't thinking like we want to fix it by restoring the landscape with native plants only. Their view was like very different, that we want to, you know, renovate the landscape, you know, ameliorate the damage and make it more beautiful with non-native plants. They didn't see these things being in contradiction. And you even had timber companies up in Northern California trying to replant former redwood forests with eucalyptus trees. Okay, so the naked kind of greed, you see this in the Sequoia country in the Sierra Nevada, also the North Coast redwood country. Some of it is just almost hard to believe today, like, you know, cutting down the very first sequoia tree ever known to the outside world within like a year of like it being discovered just for the hell of it, and then dancing on it and building a dance pavilion on it and having square dances and then cutting down its neighbor so you could create these kind of displays in New York and at the Crystal Palace in London, that big kind of, you know, Victorian pleasure dome built by Queen Victoria's husband. The U.S. government even, you know, when Chicago held the World's Fair in 1893 to celebrate 400 years of Christopher Columbus. They built, you know, a big government building in the White City, and they thought, well, what's the best way to decorate the dome, the interior dome of the government building? It's like, oh, I know, let's cut down a multi-millennial sequoia tree, even though, you know, it's the government who's supposed to be, like, protecting these trees and actually is at that point, but still the impulse was, let's just cut one down. So they did, and it was a tree named after a famous Civil War general, and they cut it down and ended up in Chicago. And then when the World's Fair went down, they shipped the tree to the mall in D.C. where it was used as a tool shed by the Smithsonian.
So it was a hollowed-out tree, wasn't it?
It was a hollowed-out tree. So they basically they topped it off, and so they had a stump of like maybe 20 feet tall. Then they hollowed out like that 20-foot section, and then basically sent that whole kind of hollowed out lower 20 feet of a giant sequoia by railroad to Chicago, and then later ended up in D.C. They put a little like roof on it, so they could use it as a tool shed. They put a little door on it. When it was in Chicago, you could like go inside and go up the stairs. It was like a little parlor room. So just like there were lots of ridiculous scenes like this. Even like P.T. Barnum had his own like redwood tree cylinder. You know, but by the 20th century, for various reasons, most sequoia trees were protected. In redwood country, it was a totally different story. By 1900, 100% of the species, as a wild-growing thing, was privately owned. I can't think of another species of tree in the whole world like this where, you know, private individuals and companies owned the entire wild-growing species. So when you think about Woody Guthrie, you know, like in the 1930s singing his protest song, "This land is my land is your land," and talks about the redwood forest, he actually could not be further from the truth. Though he does have that old lyric that was, you know, suppressed for a long time about private property and trespassing. That's much truer for redwood country because it was entirely privately owned because it was near the coast, it was near ports, it was great timber, probably the best timber in the whole world, so people desired it. And also because people acquired this land by hook and crook, just all sorts of incredible corruption in the late 19th century. And so the long, long and very tangled and messy history of redwood activism leading up to the national parks and state preserves we have today is sort of a legacy of all these trees becoming private property all at once in a very chaotic and often fraudulent way.
Well, there's, I think, a fascinating twist of history about who the early protectors of redwoods were compared to the people that probably a lot of listeners are more familiar with, like Judy Berry, who were fighting to protect the redwoods in the late 1980s and early 1990s.
Right.
So let's talk a little bit about the difference between the people who were the early advocates for the redwoods, both the coastal redwoods and the sequoias, and the people who later on became advocates for the eucalyptus.
Yeah, I mean, there's kind of three big phases, and you can sort of identify like three groups that symbolize the three phases. So the first would be this Save the Redwoods League, and the second would be the Sierra Club, and the third would be Earth First, that Judy Berry was associated with Earth First. I mean, it's more complicated than that, but that's kind of one way to kind of think about it, this kind of buttoned up kind of corporate suits, you know, working for conservation and kind of environmental groups, working through Congress and litigation, and then more like radical grassroots activists, that kind of thing. There was one important precursor, and I think I want to mention it because it is kind of this lost history, and Judy Berry makes me think of it, because for so much of this is like men dominating the story, but there was this, the first instance of redwood preservation in California, which is now Big Basin State Park on the San Francisco Peninsula, was largely the work of club women. And Phoebe Hearst actually was very involved too, as well as some Catholic groups and other grassroots organizations. But a lot of garden clubs, other women's organizations were deeply, deeply involved in the preservation of Big Basin State Park. But then you move a little forward towards like the teens and 20s, and the Save the Redwoods League. This is like a male-dominated group. And these are not just, you know, men. These are, like, rich, powerful, white, Protestant, Republican, predominantly Yale men. You know, it's a very select group of guys, and a lot of them belong to the Bohemian Club. And, I mean, they do great work, in a sense, because they save a lot of the tallest redwoods in the world, and they do it without a lot of discord, because basically they're businessmen, and they want to pay off the business owners of the redwoods at a fair market price, and they're doing these private deals, and then they donate the land to the state of California, and then they're helping then to, you know, raise money so California has a park system that can manage it. And it, and you know, a lot of these men today, you look back, and they had really noxious politics. I mean, a lot of them were actually, if not eugenical advocates, some of them were actual, like, top flight, you know, eugenicist apologists, like the kind of people like Nazis read with a great appreciation. Of course, I mean, eugenics circa 1920s was not yet tainted by Nazism, so you get to sort of judge these people on their own terms. But even on their own terms, these were not always, like, you know, maybe the best men, but they did accomplish a lot. You fast forward to the 1960s, it's a very, very different group. These environmentalists like David Brower, the famous one, he's not the only one, but the groups like the Sierra Club in the 1960s, in a sense, they rejected their forefathers in the State of the Redwood Leagues. They wanted to be more activists. They were much more anti-business and were willing to criticize companies. You know, the Sierra Club famously took out ads that, you know, attacked Georgia Pacific and other timber companies in the New York Times, things that the Save the Redwoods League would never do because they were friends with the business community. And then you fast forward to, you know, the Earth First and Judy Berry and people like that. And, I mean, you couldn't imagine a more opposite picture from the Save the Redwoods Leagues. At least there was a certain continuity between the Sierra Club and the Save the Redwoods Leagues, and there was some overlap in leadership. But, you know, Earth First was, you know, local, grassroots, decentralized, radical. It actually initially was dominated mostly by men, and Judy Berry is a really great figure in part because she was really reaching out to women and sort of criticizing Earth First for some of its kind of macho rhetoric, but also reaching out to working class people and reaching out to loggers and sort of seeing this as a movement of laborers as well as environmentalists, which is something that I think environmentalism in the 60s didn't do well. And certainly, like, these business owners from the 1920s and 30s, you know, they didn't really care so much about laborers. So it's three very distinct phases with this kind of initial road not taken with Big Basin that I wanted to mention, because I think this is generally true of politics. When there are more women involved, I want to say that usually there's a much better outcome than this is true of environmental politics, social politics, you name it. When it's largely men dictating the conversation, it's usually an incomplete conversation. I'll stop there, and you probably have more questions.
Well, this morning we're talking with Jared Farmer, who's author of Trees in Paradise, and we're talking about the species of trees in California, both native and non-native, that have really come to define the state, and some of the social tensions that they represent. I want to compare or talk about the supporters of the Redwoods, the early ones you're talking about, the Save the Redwoods League, and the way that they saw that the Redwoods reflected their sense of themselves and their own entitlement compared to the way that people who are champions of everything from the eucalyptus to the palm related and identified with the non-native aspects of those trees.
Yeah, I mean, the Save the Redwoods Leagues, I just have to point out that this is a group that's still around, and actually they do great work, and it's changed a lot. So I'm really talking about kind of like the founding generation.
They're no longer eugenicists?
No. Okay. But like the founding generation, people like, you know, Henry Osborne and Madison Grant, a lot of them were like actually East Coast patricians. They weren't even Californians. A lot of them were like buddies with Teddy Roosevelt, and they lived in Manhattan and belonged to the Boone and Crockett Club, too. And, you know, they did a lot of great work, again, not just saving redwoods, but saving whales and bison. But they did have this, like, interest in preserving, like, the best, most manly specimens of American flora and fauna, like the things that are tallest and largest, and with redwoods, like, I want to say most phallic. And, You know, and they sort of, they weren't ever explicit about it, but you don't really have to read much between the lines to sense that these white people, and they were definitely like, you know, white Anglo-Saxon Protestants in an era when, you know, American society was becoming much more diverse through immigration and much more diverse religiously, did sort of see a connection between their position as like the imperiled elite of America and these redwood trees as the imperiled elite of the American floral world, that were sort of endangered by kind of baser elements of, you know, the economy, acquisitiveness. But these trees, you know, by themselves were, you know, immense and towering and, you know, older than Rome and Jesus Christ, et cetera, et cetera. Yet there was this fear they would go extinct. And there was all this talk, too, about, like, you know, the white people in America being, you know, superior yet endangered, and they might go extinct, and like, you know, the pure racial strains. So all this talk was in the air, and I don't think it's a coincidence that a lot of these kind of blue blood patrician, you know, white men from the East Coast were really interested in these kind of totemic trees.
Well,
but if we look at Californians themselves, like people who had been in California a generation or two or three, I mean, they often, they loved redwoods too, but there was a much more of an affiliation for non-native trees, especially eucalyptus, as things that grew up with them, as things that represented a kind of changed California, a post-settler landscape. I mean, these things weren't exclusive. You had, you know, Sierra Club members in, you know, Berkeley who lived in a redwood house, you know, furnished all in redwood, who used redwood all the time. Because, you know, Californians, they were buried in redwood. And, you know, they built with redwood. They played with redwood toys. They did everything with redwood. They sat on redwood bleachers and, you know, drank wine from redwood casks, but also wanted to protect them and also love eucalyptus trees and were really sentimental about them. Today, like, I think people are a little more doctrinaire about these things. I mean,
well, let's talk about the doctrinaireness about eucalyptus trees. And I'm imagining some of the stalwart redwood supporters from the early part of the 20th century condemning the redwood, the eucalyptus, especially in the wake of the Oakland-Berkeley fire a few 20 years ago, you know, to like show that this is what happens when you let the rabble in, kind of.
Yeah. Like, could you sort of like repeat your question? I mean, I got the fire, but like, where did you want to
go? Well, just that I wanted to talk about some of the downsides of the eucalyptus.
Okay.
And I was just thinking about the ways that the eucalyptus might have been really criticized by some of the early supporters of the redwoods for the fact that they don't have the purity and the history and lineage that the redwoods had.
Yeah, but I mean, I guess the preservationists, they weren't interested in the settled part of California. They had this idea of like a pure wild California, that, you know, by the World War One era was just reduced to like a few pockets, and they really like focused all their energy and money on preserving like a few stands, like the South Calaveras Grove of sequoia trees, or right along the Redwood Highway in Humboldt County, because these trees have incredible symbolic value, not just of California before the gold rush, but of like a pure kind of Edenic North America. You know, again, this is an era when like the passenger pigeon was going extinct. I mean, this is the 100th year anniversary this year, and you know, the bison was almost going extinct. There was great fears that it would go extinct. This is when, you know, concerns about whales were really ramping up. So this idea that this era when the North American nature produced these kind of mammoth, titanic, you know, whatever adjective you want to use, these gigantic examples of flora and fauna, that was going away and we needed to preserve it. So it wasn't really about California per se. I mean, these things occurred in California, so we needed to preserve it there. But it represented something, I think, much larger about this kind of American Eden. But at the same time, I think there are these kind of, I guess, psychic or emotional resonances with these kind of waspish men. I mean, I'll give you an example, like the very first redwood grove named after somebody. because the Save the Redwoods League figured out that they could raise a lot of money if they promised to name groves after donors. And so there's a Rockefeller, the largest grove is called the Rockefeller Grove, not surprisingly, who was the richest man in the world. But there are hundreds and hundreds of trees and groves named after rich people who donated money. But the very first one was a guy who didn't donate money because he died. And he was the first officer of high rank to die in World War One. So he was, you know, he was like a general counsel for like a big industry. You know, he'd gone to, I can't remember, Harvard or Yale, and he lived in a mansion in Connecticut. He was one of those people, you know what I mean? And lots of other Americans died in World War One, but he was like the first officer of high rank. And so he got the big tall redwood named after him. So this was the kind of social equivalence the preservationists were making, but they were also interested in preserving these kind of pieces of like what they would call original America. You know, they weren't really thinking about Native Americans, but this kind of primeval, wild America, when America produced these kind of grand, titanic forms unlike anywhere on the earth. Because they were kind of like chauvinistic Americans. And
well, it seems like they completely left Native Americans out of the equation, actually.
Yeah, I just don't think that was... I don't think they cared. Yeah, that was just not...
Which is interesting, because Native Americans lived with these trees for tens of thousands of years and didn't wipe them out.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at, you know, all the timelines that Californians have put on downed redwood trees, you know, it's sort of a curatorial cliche if you go to a museum, or like in Vertigo, that Hitchcock film, there's that scene, you know, they go to Muir Woods and, you know, Kim Novak points to the timeline, and it's always, you know, like Columbus, you know, Declaration of Independence. I've actually compiled like dozens of these. Like, there's not a single one that mentions Native peoples in California. Occasionally they'll mention Tenochtitlan, or, you know, indigenous Mexico, but never, ever indigenous California.
In the last couple moments we have, I just want to just end up with some stuff about the eucalyptus, because we never did talk about the downside of the eucalyptus. So what sort of was some of the results of planting so many eucalyptus around California? And the late 20th century, what were we starting to see?
Yeah, so Californians planted them ornamentally, which really hasn't been much of a problem. You know, along roads, parks, gardens, campuses. But there were these kind of frenzied moments of afforestation when people invested in redwoods. There was a huge speculative market in eucalyptus timber about 100 years ago, and then the boom busted, and you were left with tens of thousands of acres of trees that sort of were left to go wild because basically the land went into receivership. And so these former, basically, tree plantations became kind of feral forests, mostly in the Bay Area, and then later post-war developers built homes within them, and these trees weren't managed as forests, but they sort of became forests, so they were badly managed forests, and they needed to be thinned, and you had to kind of remove a lot of the debris to remove a fire danger, but that was never done, and so there were a number of fires in the Berkeley Hills throughout the 20th century, but then leading up to a really big and deadly one in 1991. And that's when sort of the tide of opinion started to turn in the Bay Area. I mean, coincidentally, this is about the time when invasive species becomes kind of a global concern, and you have kind of a new prominent subfield of science, of invasion biology, and, you know, groups like the UN and Bill Clinton and other, you know, global leaders are talking about this. And it's also when you start to get, at the state and national level, new environmental guidelines or sometimes mandates to try to restore certain parks to a pre-settlement vegetation, whatever that means. And so for a bunch of reasons, around the 1980s, people start to reevaluate these trees. And oftentimes it's the language becomes like very exaggerated, and people talk about, you know, killer eucs and napalm trees and gasoline trees and widowmakers. And it's not like these trees are inherently dangerous, and it's not like they have on their own overran California. It's more like California's planted them by the millions. That's why they're there. They're not so much invasive as just that they were desired in the past, and so people planted them, and we now are living with the legacy of that. And when people have built houses in them, or when these sort of feral plantations have been just allowed to go wild, like above UC San Francisco at the Sutro Forest, they are a problem, and they are a fire danger, and they really should be dealt with, and I don't dispute that at all. But in many other parts of California, I think they remain beautiful, and they smell good, and more to the point, I think they're just a part of California heritage that is worth preserving. So basically, they belong in some places, they don't belong in others. I think basically you just have a little, have that little more nuance with it. Because we live in a very eco-cosmopolitan world now. Globalization, whether you like it or not, is here to stay. And we're not going to eradicate all eucalyptus trees in California, but in some areas we probably should. But that doesn't mean that they're all bad. You just sort of have to decide on a case-by-case basis if they belong here, if they don't belong there.
Well, I wish we still had time to go into more into palms and oranges, but I'll have to do that for another time.
Yeah.
But anyway, thanks a whole lot for joining us. It's
so fun talking to you. I really appreciate it. Yeah,
yeah. And maybe we could finish up in a few months. We can get back and talk about the palms and oranges because we never really talked that much about that the last time we talked either.
Okay.
So it is a big book, as you warned me in an email a while back, and so lots to talk about. So
okay.
Thanks a lot for joining us, Jared.
Okay, take care. Thank you.
And we've been talking with Jared Farmer, author of Trees in Paradise. You've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locusfocus. Next week, we'll replay an interview I did with Carl Safino 2 years ago about his book, A View from Breezy Point. And the following week, I'll be back, and my guest will be Ben West with Forest Ethics in Vancouver, BC, to talk about pipeline proposals to carry tar sands oils across the wilds of British Columbia. My engineer this morning is Joe Clement. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with some music by Joni Mitchell. Thanks for listening.
Sitting in a park in Paris, France, reading the news, and it sure looks bad. They won't give peace a chance. That was just a dream some of us had. Still a lot of lands to see, but I wouldn't want to stay here. It's too old and cold and settled in its ways here. Oh, but California, California, coming home. I'm gonna see the folks I dig. I'll even kiss a sunset pig. California, I'm coming home. Who did the goat dance very well? He gave me back my smile, but he kept my camera in a cell.
You were tuned to KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland. The time is coming around just at 11 o'clock. Up next on Health Watch, host Dr. David Naiman will be having an encore presentation of an interview with botanist, nature photographer, and writer John Kalas, founder of Wild Food Adventures. He discusses his book, Edible Wild Plants, Wild Foods from Dirt to Plate.
The purpose of this program is not to prescribe a treatment to individuals. Listeners should consult their healthcare practitioner before attempting any treatment.
Good morning and welcome to Health Watch. I'm Dr. David Naiman, your host. Today's guest is John Kalas. John Kalas has investigated edible wild plants since 1970 and taught about them since 1978. A trained botanist, nature photographer, writer, researcher, and teacher, Dr. Kalas founded Wild Food Adventures in 1993 and was the primary writer and editor of Wild Food Adventurer, a newsletter he published from 1996 to 2006. John Kalas is here on Health Watch today to talk about his book, Edible Wild Plants, Wild Foods from Dirt to Plate. And if you'd like to join the conversation today on Health Watch about wild foods, the number is 503-231-8187. Welcome to Health Watch, John.
Thank you, David.
Well, in both your book, Edible Wild Plants, and in your business, Wild Food Adventures, you advocate the harvesting and eating of wild plants. So I wonder if you can tell us why you think that's a good idea. I'm sure we have some listeners out there who are thinking, well, why can't I just go buy lettuce in the grocery store? And what would be the difference in harvesting and eating wild plants?
Well, advocate is an interesting term because I actually don't see myself as a promoter in a sense where I think everybody should do this. This is something that only people that really are excited about, you know, nature and gardening and things like that, you know, being in that kind of milieu really should be doing this. Most people, you know, they don't even have a garden. If you don't have a garden and you don't have the time for that, you're probably not going to get into wild foods that much. Unless you're big into hiking or, you know, other things that get you out into nature. But it does take a little bit of time and effort and knowledge in order to do this. You can't just wish that you know these plants. You have to know the plants before you can gather them.
And what sort of benefits do you see from the people who are motivated to learn more about wild foods? Is it primarily connecting with nature, do you think people see some nutritional benefits from eating wild foods versus their domesticated counterparts?
Well, yeah, I have a whole chapter, on why people could be excited about wild foods and how they can fit into their lives. Not only is it a fun recreational activity that you can do on your own, but this is something that a family can do together. Kids are really excited about nature. And we have a problem today that was coined nature deficit disorder. And that's where people sort of don't get into nature anymore because, number one, they don't have time or they have to watch their kids. And we have all these new laws now about letting your kids roam around. I remember when I was a kid, you know, we were 7 and we were roaming the neighborhoods on our own as a little posse of kids, you know. Today, if you did that, you could be thrown in jail for, you know, child neglect. And so when we were kids, we got to explore nature on our own. There was no supervision. Today, everyone has to be supervised. So this way, the parent can actually get out into nature, enjoy nature themselves while their children are enjoying nature, and do it with a specific purpose. And that directedness